From PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and Sandberg Media, LLC, I'm David Dalt with Things Not Seen.
Dostoevsky, Percy, O'Connor, McCarthy, they go the way of being Dostoevskian, saying, okay, there may be suffering. The rest of the world may think God is dead, but there is this possibility of living differently. And it's that very possibility that shows up as hope in their world. Their world is full of suffering. Their worlds are full of darkness, but the hope is there. There's always this light. And that's one of the things I hold on to in both of their works. It's one of the things that I hold on to probably even in the way that I view my own.
Things Not Seen is made possible in part through the generosity of our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/notseenradio. That's patreon.com/notseenradio. Thank you. Welcome to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to welcome to the program Jessica Houghton Wilson. She is the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author or editor of 8 books, including Reading for the Love of God, The Scandal of Holiness, which was the winner of a Christianity Today Award of Merit in 2023, and the book Giving the Devil His Due, Demonic Authority in the Fiction of Flannery O'Connor and Fyodor Dostoevsky, which was also a winner of the Christianity Today Book of the Year Award in 2018. Professor Wilson speaks around the world on topics as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of thinking. Today we're talking about her most recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Professor Jessica Houghton Wilson, welcome to Things Not Seen.
Thank you, David. I'm excited to be here.
So I want to start out my conversation with you expressing my gratitude. I am a Catholic who is not a fan of Flannery O'Connor. I think I'm in a very distinct minority on that front, but what I really appreciated about your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, is you gave me a glimpse into Flannery O'Connor's process, into some of the struggles that Flannery O'Connor was working with as she was creating her fiction, and you gave me more reasons why I dislike Flannery O'Connor, but you also gave me a glimpse into a path of why I might begin to appreciate Flannery O'Connor. So, just from the standpoint of complexity alone, thank you so much for that here at the outset of our conversation. And as we're getting into this, I think for listeners, because not all of my listeners are Catholic, not all of my listeners are literature readers, can you give us just a brief overview, maybe a paragraph's worth, of who was Flannery O'Connor?
Sure. So she was a Catholic novelist in the South in the middle of the 20th century. That's how she's known now. That's how we reconsider her. At the time, she was just a really popular best-selling novelist. And especially in the 1950s and 60s, people loved her work. They didn't find a lot to be Catholic about it. So she was on TV shows and public stages without people recognizing her religious faith. That kind of sneaks in there. So she's rather subversive. Nowadays, people can't help but read her through the Catholic lens. But any more than that, I can tell you her bio. She died of lupus at 39 years old, very young, 1964. She was suffering from lupus for the last 14 years of her life. And like I said, she grew up in southern Georgia, was raised there, went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, went off to Yaddo in New York and had a stint elsewhere that comes to play in her fiction. But ultimately, when she was diagnosed with lupus, she had to return home and stayed there for the rest of her life.
What I really appreciate about your answer is you're beginning to give us some glimpses of the complexity that I mentioned in my initial comments, because you've talked to us about the first reception history of Flannery O'Connor. She was seen as a really provocative writer of fiction, and the Catholicism was eclipsed, to use your word, subversive. And then more than half a century on, we now have reappraised, and there's maybe a second or even a third reception history where the Catholicism has come more to the fore. And I wonder if you can talk to us about, as you have been studying Flannery O'Connor, what are some of the dynamics at work in those different reception histories? Why did we read her differently then than we read her now?
Fantastic. So one of the best people on this is Daniel Moran, who wrote Creating Flannery O'Connor and talking about her different reception history. But early on, you have people like Evelyn Waugh, who was a British novelist during the time, who read her first novel, Why Did the Rage? Wise Blood was her first novel. And when he read it, he said, if this is truly the work of a young woman, it is astounding. He just couldn't believe that it was such a great novel and could be written by someone who was at the time 25 years old. So Flannery had a broad readership. She was getting reviewed by The Atlantic and I'm trying to list all the different magazines she would have been reviewed by, but I don't want to get them wrong. But you can imagine today's audience, she would have been in the New Yorker. She would have been in the New York Times. She wasn't going to be off and marginalized in some of the smaller Catholic presses. They didn't even claim her as one of their own. Most of the Catholics at the time thought, well, these aren't nice stories. There's nothing good about them. There's no good people. There's no heroes. You know, this is not J.R.R. Tolkien, where you have the victors are the Catholics. You just don't have that in her work. In fact, those who are the most religious usually come upon their downfall. And that was something that was not going to settle well with Catholic readers, especially in the 1950s and 60s. Later, she gets reappraised, as you mentioned, by Catholic fiction writers who see her in line with Walker Percy. And they start to see this connection between the Catholic renaissance of theology that's going on with Vatican II, and which was after Flannery, but Henri de Lubac and von Balthasar and some of these theologians that started to make sense of Flannery's fiction. And once people saw that she was within contemporary Catholics, as I mentioned with Percy, but also coming from the French Catholic tradition, and they were able to put her into a different narrative, into a different group. And once that tribe took over, people began to read her work according, I think, to how she was wanting it to be read.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author of numerous books across a range of subjects, including Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of thinking. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A Behind-the-Scenes Look at a Work in Progress. I really appreciate what you're saying about the connections and the reconsideration of Flannery O'Connor in light of the changes in the Catholic Church. So as Catholicism, and I'm thinking right now of, for example, John F. Kennedy's speech where he says, listen, I'm Catholic, but that shouldn't scare you for electing me president because I can be a Catholic and a good American. There really is a kind of trace and shift of the perception of Catholicism as something other to becoming something more mainstream that parallels the reconsiderations of Flannery O'Connor that we're talking about, where her Catholicism can come more to the fore because it becomes more acceptable to talk about a Catholic author as something other than a reason to dismiss. Now, when I say this, I'm taking your words and putting my words on them. Have I got it basically right, or would you say this in a different way? Is there something that I'm missing?
No, that's fantastic. And I think you see this also with Cormac McCarthy, who recently passed away. He was known first just as a phenomenal novelist, as a literary writer, and he was being taught in the university system. And now over the last 5 or 10 years, again, as you said, Catholicism has become mainstream. I would even say it's become more evangelical in character. It's become more involved in the American arts and in the European arts. And once it changed its place, suddenly we're reading Cormac McCarthy as a Catholic novelist. How does he fit in the tradition? How does he fit in the story? I think the same thing happened to Flannery the last 20, 30 years.
Well, now I'd like to invite your story into the narrative, because as you describe it in the introduction to your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage?, you talk about being a young writer in college, having a professor who sees talent but is frustrated by the content, and in the midst of that, puts a Flannery O'Connor short story in your hands and says, write like this. I wonder if you could flesh that out a little bit for me and my listeners.
Sure. And to put it in better context, I was even younger. I was attending college as a 15-year-old during a summer program. So I was very new to writing, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a novelist. I grew up in a Christian household, a Protestant household. in which it was really discouraged to write things that were dark and depressing because the focus was always, and this is not Catholic, but the focus was on the resurrection. The focus was on Jesus here and now and all the good things that are happening, not on Good Friday, not on Jesus still on the crucifix, which is a more Catholic mindset or Catholic image. And this professor, Boswell, actually, Professor Boswell at Rhodes College, handed me the life you say maybe your own. And here was the darkness. Here was the grit. And yet at the same time, there was this compelling undertone, what Flaherty talks about as Christ haunting in her work. And I was able to see that and perceive that and thought, this is the way you write about it. You write about the unseen things and you bring them to the surface. That vision was so compelling to me that I've spent the rest of my life studying Flaherty and trying to figure out ways of bringing the unseen to the surface.
I'm really grateful for the mention of the life you save may be your own, because if I were to name a touchstone for Flannery O'Connor, for me in my intellectual history, it would be that story. But it's that story through a series of weird lenses. I know about that story because Thomas Merton introduced that story to a friend of his in Louisville, Kentucky, a lens grinder by the name of Ralph Eugene Meatyard, who was also an amateur photographer. And Ralph Eugene Meatyard did an extended series of grotesque photographs, which are staged where children are wearing huge Halloween masks and are in sort of surrealist interactions with one another. But in every single one of these photographs, he uses the naming convention in The Life You Save May Be Your Own, which is every character that is female is named Lucy Nell Crater. And he names all of the figures in his photographs, Lucy Nell Crater standing next to his brother, Lucy Nell Crater, who are standing outside the store owned by Lucy Nell Crater. And he picks this up. So my way into Flannery O'Connor was these grotesques from Ralph Eugene Meatyard. Now, I want to ask you about this word that I've used at several points in my statement so far, grotesque, which I think has multiple meanings. It's got layers of meaning. When I use this word with Flannery O'Connor, first of all, is it an accurate word to use about her fiction? And second, if it is, what can we pull from it? What should the grotesque mean for us in Flannery O'Connor's work?
Yes, I would say you can use the word grotesque. It depends on how people are using it. So when you talk about another Southern writer like Truman Capote or Carson McCullers, they are writing the grotesque from a different worldview than Flannery. So they're writing about putting these kind of crazy shapes and ideas and weird for weird's sake almost. And so you imagine gargoyles on a building. For Flannery, those gargoyles are not just ugliness for the sake of ugliness or weirdness for the sake of weirdness. She thinks that they're dispelling the demons, that they're exorcising those things that haunt us and are not supposed to be part of our lives. And she's trying to do that with her fiction. So when she writes about freaks, for example, she sees our own human nature in its complex sinfulness, but also moving hopefully towards sanctification and those possibilities. And so she draws people as these goods under construction, which look freakish to people. They become grotesque images. And one of the reasons that I chose the artist I did too, which I won't go too much into depending on how you want to go, but Steve Prince is an African-American artist who captures this grotesque from Flannery's worldview. He shares a very similar worldview. We are goods under construction. And there is something about our nature that is both sinful and also moving towards something good.
And we're discussing the person who gives the illustrations to your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author or editor of 8 books, including Reading for the Love of God, The Scandal of Holiness, and Giving the Devil His Due, Demonic Authority and in the Fiction of Flannery O'Connor and Fyodor Dostoevsky. Professor Wilson speaks around the world on topics as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of thinking. Today we're talking about her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A Behind-the-Scenes Look at a Work in Progress.
Things Not Seen is brought to you in part by Liturgical Press. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality. They've evolved to serve the changing needs of the Christian church, and they produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all leaders looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org.
Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author of numerous books, several of them award winners. And she is a speaker who talks on topics around the world as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of reading. Today we're talking about her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Well, before the break, you were comparing Flannery O'Connor's fiction to works of other Southern writers such as Truman Capote. And you said that Flannery O'Connor was not interested in creating characters that were weird for weird's sake. And I want to dig into that a little bit because there's some correspondence that you bring into your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? And one line from this really stood out to me. Flannery O'Connor was talking about the line between two different types of hysterical, the hysterical ha-ha and the hysterical eat. And it seems to me that Flannery O'Connor took that line very seriously, that she wanted to always balance a kind of real glimpse at complexity and even darkness without verging into caricature. Now, when I say this to you, first of all, do I have that tension right in O'Connor? And can you tell us more about how O'Connor thought about that tension in the writing and the rewriting of her fiction?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That is such a fantastic question. So Flannery also said that everything tragic she wrote was also comic, or it was also comedy to view the tragedy. She was constantly playing with these two elements. And that's where, of course, we get the grotesque, is profane and sacred, comic and tragic. And a lot of the things that we, from limited perspectives, sometimes view as tragic, we can't see the fuller story. And so Flannery is always trying to say, what is the fuller picture? What is happening here on a comic or comedic level too? And I think the tragedy, for example, the bodies in her fiction or the deaths in her fiction, she knows she's writing fiction. She's not writing news. She's not reporting on something real that happened. What she's trying to do is she's trying to bring the reader to a point that they face the greatest horrors in this world and said, okay, what do I believe? Is this the end of the story? Does the story end here with the elements and with the body being the corpse on the ground? Or is there something else? It's like Socrates said, you can't hurt me. All you will hurt is my body, right? There's something eternal about who Socrates is. And she's trying to point us towards that eternal state and that eternal being that goes beyond the tragedy of the here and now.
What I really love about that answer, and I want to lift up a phrase that you used. You said, she knows she's writing fiction. And this ties into another line from your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, that really struck me. Flannery O'Connor is not trying to save her characters. She's trying to save the souls of her readers. Now, first of all, have I remembered that correctly? And if I have, unpack that for us.
Sure. In the middle of teaching Flannery, this was something that I think I assumed and I didn't explicitly say. And so I would teach her to students, and over and over again, the students would be like, but the main character just got gored by a bull, or the main character just got shot in the heart. Like, how can we read this? And I just had to point out to them, well, the whole point is, how are you responding? That's what she's getting at. There's not actually a real person. There's no Mrs. May. There is no character named the grandmother here. She's not actually killing anybody off. What she's saying is, what do you think? What do you believe when you see these moments, when you see these images? If you walked into a cathedral and you looked at the stained glass, what do you see? What does it do to you? Right? She's moving beyond the storytelling just for its own pathos, but the pathos in some ways, that emotion, tests what it is that you believe about the real world.
I really like this so much. And as O'Connor is doing this, as O'Connor is thinking about the souls of her readers, What do we know from her actual biography? How much contact did she have with her readers? How was she gauging the effect of this fiction on the potential souls of potential readers?
Yes, I don't know how much satisfaction she was able to gain during her lifetime from her reading, because she had a short publishing history. She had about, as I said, 12 to 14 years of actually getting to see how people were responding to her work. And she was getting lots of letters and lots of correspondence. She was also traveling as much as she could. So she would go to universities and she would give these talks and she would be on these panels with other people, other literary writers who had read her work as well. So she was getting to see some of the response within a certain amount of time. But because she was doing something so experimental and so different, I think we're seeing greater effect now as people begin to understand from her letters and her library and her journals what it is that she was doing. And she opened her eyes even more to be able to read her fiction well, in a way that at the time it was shock, it was scandal, it was startling. I think those shocks and startles and signals to something beyond itself, right? I think the shock stayed with people enough that some people were then pointed a new direction, but others found it so distasteful, they walked away. Maybe I can mention one more thing. I was just teaching Kierkegaard this week and he talks about, I'm going to be such a distasteful writer, everyone pointed on me. Right? And they're going to find what I'm doing so problematic. It's okay. And Kierkegaard died, I think, with that happening. Nobody was reading him, but now we're reading him and we're like, thank you for fear and trembling, right? Thank you for putting us on edge there and for writing something so distasteful to your current readers so that your future readers can actually enjoy it.
Well, and this is one of the things that I treasured so much about your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? Because you're giving us a glimpse behind the scenes to the process that Flannery O'Connor used in the writing of fiction. You mentioned in our first segment, Evelyn Waugh's appraisal and saying, this writer is so young and yet she manages to write so well. And what you show us is that it wasn't the writing, it was the laborious rewriting and rewriting to try and get it correct. And so what you're giving us here in this book that you've crafted for us is not a complete Flannery O'Connor novel. Why Do the Heathen Rage doesn't exist as a completed work, but you're taking from these various attempts, some of which are radically different from other attempts, to bring us into the process. And I wonder now if we could shift and you could talk to us a little bit about Flannery O'Connor's writing process. What did you discover as you were going into these archives?
Oh, fantastic. So there's things that people know, Flannery O'Connor lore, that everybody knows about Flannery, that she would work for 3 hours a day, that she worked without stopping every single day, that it became almost a religious practice. People call her a hermit or a monk now that we reconsider her in light of her Catholic faith. But this was something that she did without fail every single day. She said you had to sit there, even if you read, and she was typing. Even if you retyped what you typed the day before, which is why we have so many repetitive pages in the archives, because she would sit there and she would rewrite and maybe only change a few words at a time because she was trying so much to get into her world and into her books and to be faithful to the writing process to see what would come of it. And of course, she had what she was able to see over her lifetime, that this process was working. Over the last 14 years, she had 2 successful novels. She had all these O. Henry Awards. She'd had amazing success with her short stories. So this is not someone who's trying a process and just beating her head against a wall. This is a process that works. And yet she also knew that sometimes you are beating your head against the wall. She said both in writing her second novel and in writing this third novel, she felt like a squirrel on a treadmill and that there were often times where she was just repeating this process. So as I'm going through her pages, I didn't realize how much she was constantly retyping what she had done before. I knew that she was someone who meticulously crafted. I was able to see her go back and forth draft after draft with just things like girl, woman, girl, woman, girl, woman, with changing the names of her characters, the particularity. She didn't just stick with Walter and know who Walter was. She tried, do I call him Julian? Is he actually Asbury from my other stories? Who is this person? Or Una, Sarah, trying to figure out who her characters were. And she was paying a lot of close attention to who they were. I also didn't realize that she wrote so many backstories. So if you look at her Why Did the Heathen Rage manuscripts, you get to see she writes sometimes about who they were as children, who their family members were. And she does the same thing in Why Did the Heathen Rage. Before you even get to the heart of the novel, she starts trying to unpack, okay, who was Walter as a kid? Did he ever get baptized in the Protestant world? What would that have been like? Who was Una as a child? How was she raised? And maybe those things would have never ended up in the actual novel, but those are some of the pages that were left behind. So we get to see more about what her process meant to her, and maybe even how to imitate it for those who are really amazing writers. They get to see, this is a successful genius who wrote well. What can we learn from even her process? Not just as readers, but as writers.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author of numerous books, many of them award winners. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. So as we are looking at Flannery O'Connor's process and the meticulous ways in which she's going back, sometimes retyping pages, changing only a few words, trying on different personas for the various characters in her stories, I wonder if you could give us a précis, just a brief sort of line out for us briefly. What is the story that you uncovered in Why Do the Heathen Rage? And recognizing that this is going to be one possibility among many combinatorial possibilities from the archives with which you were working.
This is the reason that I decided to publish this, because even just the premise of the novel is so good. And to imagine that Flannery was working on this, I think just to imagine the premise, we see a change in Flannery O'Connor and what she could have been capable of had she lived longer. So the premise of the novel is that you have what starts as a typical Flannery O'Connor story, a little formulaic. You have a white Southern intellectual man. He's gone off and got an education. He's returned home. He has an overbearing mother. He has a father in this case, which usually the fathers are killed off. But he has an inept father who's had a stroke. Flannery O'Connor also, of course, lost her father young. So she kind of leaves him there on the porch and through most of the story, this father figure. And then you have a sister who is the wrong kind of education. She's a school principal. Again, something that kind of goes on in Flannery's work. Progressive education is always belittled in Flannery's work. So you have what looks like a formula. But here's where it gets a little different. And I think it could have become very prophetic. He is writing letters to people pretending to be someone else. And we almost see a foretaste of our current social media personalities. You put yourself out there in a different way. You pretend, you put on these different hats. You pretend to be different people in a public sphere than you actually are. And when he's doing this, he's being very condescending. He thinks he's so intellectual. He's so smart. He's above everybody else. And he starts corresponding with a woman named Una Gibbs, who's in New York, who has embraced this religion that is all-encompassing. She said that she's broken through the ceiling of religion into a spiritual plane, and the spiritual plane has given her insight into all people are loved and beloved, and she's going to love everyone. She's going to live among the poor, almost Dorothy Day-ish, but maybe not quite, because she's not Catholic. And Walter starts making fun of this and testing this woman's faith. And as they start corresponding, of course, what happens is he pretends to be Black. It's one of the hats he puts on, so has epistolary blackface is what I call it. And Una then says that she still loves him anyways. And he is just doesn't even know what to do with this. He's like, you wouldn't if you touched me. You wouldn't if you were in person and not just through the mail. And she says, okay, I'm coming. And that's how the whole novel starts. And it's one of those moments where it's, okay, you're coming. Now what? Now what's going to happen when these two characters interface? And of course, then we don't get to see. I mean, it's one of the greatest cliffhangers, I think. You go back to all the unfinished novels for me that you look at, Edwin Drood with Charles Dickens or Sanditon with Jane Austen, and it's like, why didn't you finish this book? So it's a great setup. It's a great premise. And I keep wishing that she would have finished it.
Well, and first of all, thank you for that. And just in the retelling of it in this brief overview, I, like you, am wishing that we knew what would happen after this cliffhanger. But what I really like about what you do in your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, is that you take that moment of what you call epistolary blackface, and then you begin to analyze it, and you say, this was something of a weakness, and that's my word, not yours, but something of a weakness in Flannery O'Connor. Someone who was so meticulous trying to figure out the backstories of someone like, you mentioned the character Walter, was he baptized? What was that like? She had, as you see it, a real difficulty imagining the lives of African Americans. Now, when I bring this into the conversation, first of all, am I recalling correctly? And if I am, what can you tell us about that? Unpack that for us.
I think she gives herself a little bit of protection too, because she knows her weakness in the fact that she knows it's almost like she herself is Walter, right? For a white person to pretend to have a black voice and male, she realizes she felt limited. She could not actually write out dialogue between African Americans the way that she wishes she could, because she was always observing them. And so she was never in the conversation. She was never in the moment. She could never be a black person talking to another black person and really get to hear things authentically. It was always her intervening in a very segregated world into those moments. So she always saw herself as an outsider, even to the extent that she saw African-Americans as other, even to the extent, and I think this, it really is a detriment to her work because of the world that she lived in, that she couldn't see enough humanness. She couldn't see enough commonality. Whereas I talk about it in the book, there are other writers in the past who have been able to overcome that because they've been able to say, we're all human, male, female, black, white. We're able to at least talk to each other and write about each other in human ways.
And you mentioned that she died young at 39. She lived long enough to see the first blushes of the civil rights movement, but the real kind of cultural connection of the civil rights movement on a mass scale really occurred in the late 60s, and she died right before the mid 60s. How do you, and I recognize this is pure conjecture, how do you think that her fiction would have matured in the face of that kind of cultural moment? Do you think that she would have risen to that occasion and would have found a way to have a deeper connection with these kinds of experiences?
I would hope so. And that's about all that I can say, is that I would hope so. I do see a difference in Walker Percy. So Walker Percy stayed in the South, Catholic, very aristocratic upbringing. And yet, despite some of the racism of his previous generations, he himself became more of an activist. He wrote letters. He went to trials where he was actually witnesses on behalf of African-American neighbors and so forth. And so he was constantly more involved. But this is in the 70s and 80s. You know, this is not something that he was involved with as much in the 40s and 50s. And so Flannery wouldn't have had that opportunity during her lifetime. Or she could have. There were moments. I shouldn't say that. There were moments where she could have had those opportunities, but the world that she lived in, she felt dominated who she could be and what she could do. And she was in a different position, both as a woman, both as someone who had lupus and had certain limitations. And of course, then also living in a segregated world, dependent on a mother who was racist to be able, and I feel bad even saying that about Rodina, but I don't know that there's any other way to portray that. And so having those kind of limitations and the people around you, I don't know for sure what would have happened with her. All I can do is say I would hope so.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're delighted today to be speaking with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author or editor of 8 books, including Reading for the Love of God, The Scandal of Holiness, which in 2023 was a winner of a Christianity Today Award of Merit, and the book Giving the Devil His Due, Demonic Authority in the Fiction of Flannery O'Connor and Fyodor Dostoevsky, which in 2018 won Christianity Today's Book of the Year Award. Professor Wilson speaks around the world on topics as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of reading. Today we're discussing her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. Each week on our program, we bring you a rich conversation about culture and faith. If you're enjoying these conversations, please go to our website, thingsnotseenradio.com. There you'll find more than 10 years of these sorts of interviews and conversations, all available for free for your listening pleasure. We're delighted today to be speaking with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author of numerous award-winning books, and she speaks around the world on topics as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of reading. Today, we're talking about her recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Well, we left in our last segment on this question of the limitations that Flannery O'Connor had in writing the perspectives of African American characters. She didn't feel that she could properly inhabit that voice. And that, as you were saying, had to do in part with the culture she was living in, the family that she was living in. Are there any other aspects or dimensions of the racial aspect of her fiction or of her considerations of racism in her situation that you'd like to add into the conversation?
Sure. I think in 2020, these letters that most of us in the Flannery O'Connor world, scholars, have always known and always been reading, they were allowed to be published by the estate in a book by Angela Alemo O'Donnell about Flannery O'Connor, her radical ambivalence when it came to race and how that appeared in her fiction. And when these were published, there was letters in which she didn't want James Baldwin to come to her home. And there were two reasons for that. One in which race was involved. It was her mother's home, not hers. And her mother would not have greeted James Baldwin. And Flannery knew that. And she said that. This is the home that I live in and I can't permit him here. If I was in New York, I would love to meet with him. The second has more to do with pretension. You see Walter being this white intellectual who's pretentious. You see Una Gibbs being this white intellectual who's pretentious. And so she wrongly probably identified James Baldwin as someone who she thought was pretentious. And that was the second part of it. And so I don't think that part had anything to do with race. In fact, when it came to people who were doing actual work, who were on the ground and being active towards civil rights, she had nothing but admiration. Father McGowan, Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Day. There was this constant sense in her work or her letters behind the scenes where she said, wow, and she uplifted people like that in her writing. So I think it's just important to hold both of those things in context and not just look at one side of the picture and blame her versus seeing the other side of the picture.
Well, so let me put the question to you directly. You mention in your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, the work of Paul Ely, who has a real kind of plants a flag in the ground that Flannery O'Connor in reassessment is a racist and needs to be assessed as a racist. You take a different position, and I wonder if you could help us to understand how you view Flannery O'Connor on the race question in distinction from someone like Paul Ely's reading.
Right. I think racist is a problematic term because it reduces a person. So anytime you have a label on someone, which is why I even hesitated to say Regina was a racist, like, I don't think that's accurate to be able to put a label on someone who was in progress, because all of us are in process. When I look back at myself and my own upbringing, were there times that I didn't understand certain issues, that I didn't understand certain people, that I would have seen incorrectly, that I treated people poorly? And not just about race, I'm just talking about in general, in which I maybe thought someone was pretentious, the way that Flannery's talking, and that I didn't have charity towards other people. If all of us can admit that is the way that we have been, and we've all learned and grown, our vision's been expanded over our lifetime, that we're constantly being able to see things more clearly, or hopefully we are, that's what I see with Flannery. So to put a flag in the ground and say a 39-year-old writer was racist in 1964 in the South is problematic. To see that she also was on her way, and the way that she wrote when she was 20 and the way that she considered race at 20 was very different than the way she considered race at 39, I think shows us that the way she would have considered race at 59 or 79 would have been different. And that she was on a road that I think all of us should applaud, and that each of us probably see in our own lives waves that we've been moved out from some sort of blindness, whatever that is, towards hopefully some sort of clarity in our lives.
Now, you're reading Flannery O'Connor with generosity. Flannery O'Connor as a persona, you use the phrase, this person was on a journey, and at 39 may have been different from 59 and 79. Can we read that dynamic back into the mechanics of Flannery O'Connor's fiction itself? The characters that she's presenting to us, are they personas on a journey? Is this why she worked so hard to make sure that she wasn't presenting mere caricatures? As I say all this, these are my words, not yours. Have I got it right, or would you say it in a different way?
Yeah, and this is something that I explored in my first book where I compare Flannery O'Connor to Dostoevsky, because when reading Dostoevsky, you read someone like Bakhtin who says that we are all unfinalizable. And when you start to consider people as unfinalizable, it matches with another writer, Marcel, who would say that we were homo viator, that we are like human beings on the way. So we're these unfinalizable creatures on the way. We are these pilgrims. And you see this most clearly in Dostoevsky, but Dostoevsky was a huge influence on Flannery and the ways that she was trying to write. So she too is trying to not villainize her character. She's not trying to have soul heroes that are completely innocent without any failings or any human realism to them. So in the same way that she's not going to have a complete bad person who is unmanned and is demonically possessed to the point of not being human, she doesn't have those kinds of characters at the forefront. Those are not the ones that we get to enter their story. Sometimes I think that those characters take place on the margins in Flannery's work and they become devices for some of the things she's doing, but they're definitely not the central characters in her work.
So you mentioned Dostoevsky, and this actually brings up a question that I wanted to ask you. What are some of the parallels? What drew you into Flannery after working with Dostoevsky? How do you see these two writers who are from such vastly different backgrounds, how do you see them in parallel and in dialogue with each other?
Absolutely. I get to teach great books. So I get to teach the history of ideas going back to Epic of Gilgamesh and Homer all the way up till now. And one of the things that you see is that there's this trend that happens in the 1800s where God is dead between Hegel and Nietzsche, and then how people respond to it. So you have someone like Kierkegaard responding in one way where, okay, God is dead. What is faith? So God can't be dead, right? Trying to prove this like ability to have something beyond the empirical world. And Dostoevsky and O'Connor follow in that tradition. They're not Nietzscheans. They see this choice has now been made for them between being Nietzschean or being Kierkegaardian. And in a sense, Dostoevsky, Percy, O'Connor, McCarthy, they go the way of being Dostoevskian, saying, okay, there may be suffering. The rest of the world may think God is dead, but there is this possibility of living differently. And it's that very possibility that shows up as hope in their world. Their world is full of suffering. Their worlds are full of darkness, but the hope is there. There's always this light. And that's one of the things I hold on to in both of their works. It's one of the things that I hold on to probably even in the way that I view my own thing.
A guest of mine from a couple of months back, Jennifer Banks, wrote a book on natality where she has this sort of thesis that a lot of philosophers, particularly male philosophers, think about the good death and collapsing life down to one moment. And she chooses instead to read Hannah Arendt and others who inject into every moment the possibility of something new being birthed, what she calls natality. So as I'm hearing you talking about Dostoevsky and Flannery O'Connor, I'm hearing this tension between mortality, fatality, and something more like natality. As I present this to you, does that sound right? And what would you say about that?
Absolutely. So if you go back all through history, you either have those who think we end in the ashes or those who believe in phoenixes. And which one are you? Are you the one who believes in the ashes or the phoenix? And so for me, it's that new birth, to quote Jennifer. It's this idea that something can rise out of the ashes. It's the idea that even, as I mentioned earlier, the corpses in the story of Flannery O'Connor are not the end. The corpse is supposed to lead to a rebirth for the reader, that there should be some way that you close a book of Flannery O'Connor and you are ready to be a phoenix.
Well, what strikes me about this is that this is resurrection language. This is Catholicism. This is Christianity. Now, when I say that to you, am I putting too many planks on the deck, or can it bear the weight of this?
Well, as someone who believes that Christianity is true, I don't think you can put too many planks on the deck. So for me, I see stories like this in the pagan world in which they talked about resurrection without using resurrection language. And I just think, yes, because Christianity is true. So you see resurrection language all over the place. You see it even in the fact that things have to die in order to then bloom. Dostoevsky uses that epigraph from the Gospel of John in which he says, unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground, it doesn't bear any fruit. But when it dies, it bears much fruit. So it is resurrection language in both of their work. They were never wanting to just say the death is the end, right? The tragedy is the end. There was always a comedy. There was always a happy ending, even if it took place after the pages were closed.
If you're just joining us, this is Things Not Seen. I'm David Dalt. We're speaking today with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author of numerous award-winning books. And today we're talking about her most recent one, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Well, in your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage?, you talk about the first day you arrive at the archives, and you talk about a windowless room, and they bring in, you can't photograph, but you can bring your computer and take notes, and they bring in all of these folders, and you start going through folder after folder. I imagine you had an idea of Flannery O'Connor at that particular point as you're entering that room in the archives. And I imagine that you have an idea of Flannery O'Connor now that you have this finished work, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, out in print. How has Flannery O'Connor changed for you in that journey?
That's a great question. So when I went into those archives, that would have been 2010. And 2010, I probably was more of a hagiographer. I was someone who she had influenced so much of how I saw the world and how much I had thought about. And all I could see was all the good that she had done. It was very difficult for me to even wrestle with some of the other aspects of her work. But as I began to not necessarily humanize, maybe that's the wrong phrase, but in some sense, yeah, get to know her more as a writer and as a person, get to see her handwriting on the pages, getting to imagine her putting it into her typewriter, visiting her home several times over the last decade or so, and getting to imagine her space and where she breathed and where she talked and where she ate. And in some ways, getting to imagine that I too am a writer and wanting to see, like, how would people read me when I'm gone? How would they understand my process? Where am I blind? What are the mysteries that I haven't answered? What are the things that I can't see? So I think for Flannery, she came home to me in a different way, a way that made her more human, didn't disrespect her genius, didn't lower her as an artist in my mind, and at the same time, almost put that within reach for all human beings. What are some ways that we too can take our work that seriously, that we can give time to our craft, to be able to dedicate it to good ends the way I think Flannery did? So less of an idol, more of an icon for me, I think, over my journey with Flannery.
Well, let me ask now a related but slightly different question. And if this feels too far off the page, I'm happy to withdraw it. But in this process, you mentioned that you are a person of faith. How has your idea of your faith shifted during the time of your intense engagement with Flannery O'Connor, given that she was very concerned in her writing about the state of your soul as a reader? How has your soul been enriched by this engagement with Flannery O'Connor?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and even just thinking about the time that I've engaged, it was different in 2010 than it was in 2020. 2020, we had the Black Lives Matter protests that were, to me, so beneficial for my work, actually, because I was in the middle of writing these things and thinking about Flannery in one way, putting her in 1964, and all of a sudden she was brought up to my present very quickly. How do I write about her in this realm? How do I see Una as somewhat of a good character, knowing that Flannery didn't want to villainize? How can I see this pretentious civil rights activist as also having a good heart? How can I be generous towards her in a way that maybe I wouldn't have been before? Right? How? And I think that's how I transitioned, being more generous even towards Flannery's characters that I think I had caricatured, not in her writing, though her writing was unfinished, but even in my process of reading, I had seen a certain way and was able to open up over the last decade to see the characters themselves as homo viator, as on their way to.
Let's assume that as a result of this conversation, some of my listeners now are on fire and they want to dive into Flannery O'Connor. Should they just go out and buy the collected short stories and just start from page one? How would you recommend they best begin to get into the fiction of Flannery O'Connor?
Yeah, without just being a plug for myself, I would say please go buy the book because I think that this is at least a good bookend. It's not a start. It's definitely for someone who has read Flannery before you buy my book. But I would hope that this becomes part of the story in the way that you address Flannery. But when you start with the collected works, read from the back, the beginning. Start with Revelation. Start with the story that she wrote on her deathbed that I think is just one of her best stories, to really get into what she could have done and who she would have been as a writer. And you get to see the pinnacle of her career from my perspective. That short story should blow you away. Read it not just once. Read it once and then read it again and then read it again before you read even any of the other stories. I think Flannery's stories are meant to be meditated on that way. I think they're meant to be read closely and not just once and forgotten, but really they should become part of how we see things.
I really appreciate this. And I want to make sure that this is clear for our listeners. Start by reading backwards. Start with the last story and read forwards. And what I really love about this is how much it complements your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? Because if we start with the finished final story, And we work our way backwards through the corpus, and we understand and we begin to see some of the dynamics that are at play here as the writer is maturing. You take us then back into the granular nature of the process, how much love she put into every word on every page. And so in that sense, I think absolutely your book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage, is a wonderful addition and complement to this conversation that we're having about Flannery O'Connor. Professor Jessica Houghton Wilson, I just want to say again how much I appreciate, as a person who was critical of Flannery O'Connor and still has my doubts sometimes, how much more rich the landscape is for me now as a result of what you did in this wonderful book, Flannery O'Connor's Why the Heathen Rage. This behind-the-scenes look at this work in progress gave me handholds for someone that I had found elusive before. I know that my listeners will find it to be a valuable amount of time of reading to get into this and to learn about the complexities of this amazing writer. Thank you so much for the time that you took researching, working in the archives on this book. But thank you especially for this conversation today. I have truly enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, David. I have to. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking today with Jessica Houghton Wilson. She's the Fletcher Jones Endowed Chair of Great Books at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California. She's the author or editor of 8 books, including Reading for the Love of God, The Scandal of Holiness, and Giving the Devil His Due, Demonic Authority in the Fiction of Flannery O'Connor and Fyodor Dostoevsky. Those last two books are award winners, I might add. She speaks around the world on topics as varied as Russian novelists, Catholic thinkers, and Christian ways of thinking. Today we've been talking about her most recent book, Flannery O'Connor's Why Do the Heathen Rage? A behind-the-scenes look at a work in progress. Things Not Seen is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC. We're distributed nationally by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Today's show was recorded at the William Adams Studios in beautiful Hyde Park, here on the south side of Chicago, Illinois. Our theme music is composed by Gene Kija. Our show is made possible in part by the generosity of supporters on Patreon. You can find out how to help us create great programs by going to patreon.com/notseenradio. You can follow us on Twitter at notseenradio. Visit us on Facebook and like our page to receive regular updates about the show and find out more about our guests. That's facebook.com/thingsnotseenradio. And you can sign up for the free podcast, listen to old shows, send us an email, and find out more about our guests if you visit us on the web at thingsnotseenradio.com. I'm David Dalt, and we'll be back next week with more conversations about culture and faith. Please join us.